It just feels like being in a sci-fi movie or something.
Yeah, it feels exactly.
You know,
like it. I feel like I've been preparing for this my whole life in that regard.
Yeah, I feel like I should have paid closer attention during all those, you know, alien invasion post-apocalyptic films.
Pretty much. It's all coming up, nerd. Now
this is when we see that the nerds will inherit the earth,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
This is off script.
I've decamped to my in-laws in Tokoroa, in New Zealand's beautiful central Waikato.
That's good. What made you decide to go up there?
Partly because, well, I'm still working, right? Because us journalists, essential workers that we are, I'm still working, so it just gives us an extra couple of pairs of hands with our two small children. One of those pairs of hands actually used to be a teacher aide in primary schools, so it was phenomenally helpful.
That's great, yeah.
But they also have tons more space. They have a massive flat double section, so there's tons of room for the kids to, like, run around, ride their bikes. And, I mean, I live on a slope in Wellington with no really good usable outdoor space, and... yeah, it just sort of made sense to bring our bubble up here.
That does sound good. The space is you're gonna really need that, I reckon.
I mean, right now they're just like going mental, riding their bikes round and round in this enormous driveway that my in-laws have, which is like literally the size of my house, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome.
How have you been getting on?
Pretty good. I've got my own secret stash. I've been hoarding my own stash of snacks because we did the first day. I've been at home for over a week now already, yeah. But basically the first 2 days ate everything and couldn't stop eating. Like, I literally was like, what is going on? Have I got given myself worms or something? I don't know what's happening. Couldn't stop eating. That was a bit grim, but it was kind of like, why? But it was kind of panic. I was actually panic eating and stress eating, which I never ever thought was a real thing, but oh man, it's real. It's like, if I don't have something in my mouth constantly, something's
gone wrong.
But it's
also just the thing of when you're at home, like, I graze a lot when I'm at home. I mean, I definitely eat a lot more when I'm at home than when I'm at work, because I just know that I have everything like right there, and it's like, I'll take a 5 minute break and walk to the kitchen, you know?
Yeah, and make myself
it's
a
so
cheese
easy
sandwich.
To do.
Yeah, and then, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Like, one of our colleagues posted on Facebook, you know, trying to be kind of philosophical, let us all be different at the end of this. And I was like, I think I'm going to be 5 or 6 kilos heavier.
I saw that, yeah. I was like, same. But then this morning I got this rush of blood to the head and did like an online Zumba class. Like, the teacher was live up in Auckland, and it was really fun. Like, obviously I'm completely devoid any rhythm or movement talent whatsoever. So it was
isolated at home has always been my philosophy.
Yeah. Like, you never want to do that stuff in a class with a bunch of other people.
Sorry, my bubble just got invaded.
It's okay.
Let me just get the switch. Thank you. Okay.
They so want to be on those podcasts. We're going to have to get them on as guests one day, I think.
We are. Well, and today's topic is sort of relevant to them.
Today's topic is relevant to them.
Yeah.
It's kind of completely irrelevant to me, but I'm still going to participate in it.
Well, I mean, you know, it takes a village. Like, we're all responsible for giving the next generation good taste, I think.
True.
That's a community responsibility.
I've tried as well as I can with my nephews, but... one of them has zero interest in anything that I'm interested in. In fact, if I even express the merest hint of interest, that's it. It's over. And the other one I've tried, and to you know, mixed reception from him.
Right.
But
I do think that there's, you know, like, I think that if you just keep telling them the same things over and over, even if they profess not to like it right now, I think if you just pummel them enough, then there's a sort of osmosis effect.
That's right. It sinks in.
They're going to wind up at some point. Maybe it doesn't even matter if they like it. It's more just like, it's going to be a permanent fixture in their pop cultural frame of reference.
That is so true. Because when I was growing up, It was me and my brother, and there's only like 18 months between us.
Yeah.
And when we were growing up, he was a massive metalhead. And I liked, you know, Roxy Music and Duran Duran and like art pop kind of crap like that.
Yeah.
And now Duran Duran are like far and away one of his favourite bands. And I love Kiss. So that's the trade-off
there
that we've
go.
Had. And I like know every single lyric to every single Iron Maiden song, which is something I'm quite proud of, actually. Deep down.
That's huge. There's a lot of huge. I mean, Iron Maiden has quite a big catalogue.
There's a huge catalogue, and I know them all, even the first album that Bruce Dickinson's not even on.
Wow.
Speaking of Bruce Dickinson, did you see that people have been, like, begging him online to, like, British people begging him online to fly his jet and rescue them from places around the globe where they're stuck and can't get home?
No.
I meant to tell you about that. It'll be a good story for work, actually. I must find it, but...
It would be.
I'll flick it to you for still be available, and lots of flights have been cancelled. Sword and stuff. I don't know. We don't know. I mean, you never know.
Oh, Kylie, you know how I love to judge people who I don't know and whose situations I'm not totally familiar with.
Oh, yeah. It's one of your most endearing qualities. It's what first drew you
Will
to
you
me.
Will you deny me this pleasure during my time of trial?
Never, ever. Why don't you explain exactly what today's episode is about?
Well, so today we thought, you know, so now in New Zealand, we're in, as in other places around the world, we're in official lockdown. So everybody is to stay at home with their designated people who we're referring to as their bubble, which means that there are, I mean, I was thinking this morning, I've never spent this much time with my husband. Like, I've never spent this much solid time with him ever
even when you were living in the tiny apartment in Paris.
But we still went out to work every day.
Mm.
You know? We were very close to each other when we were at home in our 21 square metre apartment, but we didn't spend this much solid time in each other's company. And then for the last 6 years, you know, he's been working in restaurants, either managing other people's or owning his own. So I mean, we spend a lot of time apart, but anyway, that's a side issue. So there's a lot of parents out there spending a lot of time with their children, which means doing a lot of the things that your children want to do. But I think this is also a perfect opportunity to introduce your children to some of the pop cultural things that are important to you and that you want them to, that you also want to be important to them from generation to generation.
Yeah, handing down pop culture knowledge.
Yeah, that's right.
Beautiful.
So today, Kylie and I are each going to pick a film, some music, and a book that were really important to us when we were young and that continue to have relevance to us today and that we want the next generation to also embrace.
Mm.
Kick us off, Kylie. What's your movie?
I've noticed that the three things I chose were all sort of important to me when I was in my early and mid-teens.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I haven't got anything from my childhood, which I try, just like, I had a perfectly fine childhood, actually. I was going to say I try not to think of, but I just remember it being a bit, I didn't really know who I was. And these are all sort of touchstones from when I sort of started to be my own person, I guess, which is just an interesting aside.
It is interesting. Yeah.
And they are like three of my favourite things in the whole wide world. But anyway, the movie I've chosen is a classic. It's executive produced by Steven Spielberg, as my entire teenage hood was. And
I think the world is at this point.
Yeah. It was 1985 adventure comedy called The Goonies.
I love this movie. It's such a great movie.
And I can honestly say that even as an adult, Goonies is still my favourite film, I think. It's the film that I feel the most kind of affection for.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know I can't imagine anybody hasn't seen it or doesn't have a general idea of what the film is about, but it's basically a group of kids live in the seaside, sort of working class seaside town in Pacific Northwest. And their little kind of corner of the world is being bought out by local country club. They're going to turn it into a golf course. And they all live together. These five kids are all really great mates. Anyway, and all, like, one of the kids, a bit of pie in the sky, Mikey, he's played by Sean Astin.
I remember having some sort of complicated feelings about Sean Astin.
When I was, I actually also had those feelings. But I was kind of torn between him and Josh Brolin, his older brother. Yeah. Although he spends a lot of that film in kind of really awkward 80s sportswear. So it's sort of, I don't know, up in the air. But feelings. But anyway, so the kids are kind of entertaining themselves and they discover in the attic of Mikey's house a literal pirate's treasure map. And then they go on this insane adventure through the caves and the cave system underneath this kind of seaside town, in the search for One-Eyed Willie's in the search for One-Eyed Willie's treasure. And on their tail is a very 80s, horribly stereotyped trio of Italian gangsters. The Fratellis, when you think about it now, is kind of incredibly awkward and would never happen in a movie now. Sorry, I said trio, but there's actually four of them.
There's also a kid called Chunk.
Chunk, my goddamn. He was my absolute hero as a child. Like, Chunk. He was also sort of slightly torturous because people used to call me Chunk and I'd be like, don't even know what to do with that.
There's also a bit, so my dad always used to love watching the Goonies because... Oh, sorry, my daughter wants to show me what she has. What do you have? A biscuit? Lucky you, sorry. Romy's lockdown fashion today is leggings, the bottom half of a mermaid costume.
Don't knock it. I think that's going to be everybody's lockdown fashion in a couple of weeks' time. We'll all be wearing togas.
Anyway... So there's a bit where the younger of the Fratellis, I mean, again, it's all like you just couldn't do that today. The youngest of the Fratellis is deformed. He's like a kind of mutant type thing.
Yeah.
And they call him, just to go with Chunk, they call him Sloth. Sorry. What do you have, Sam? Is it a biscuit?
Oh, I want a cupcake.
I'm so sorry.
That's all right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So there's a bit where Sloth is like bearing down on Chunk and Chunk thinks he's about to die and he goes, "Brohatadano." And my dad used to think that was great because he just loved it when anyone anywhere was Jewish. That's a moment I always think of when that's I think fantastic. Of the Goonies. Yeah, sorry.
No, that's good. No, that's awesome. That's awesome. I really want to watch it again now because it's actually pouring down here and it's very grey. And one of the things I love about the film is that it has this sort of overcast, rainy atmosphere that I don't know, it really just created this cozy feelings in me when I was a teen and I loved it. And it's a very similar weather today actually here in Wellington, so that's quite interesting. But anyway, so one of my greatest, perhaps my only real claim to fame is that I am an honorary Goonie. And I was made an honorary Goonie by Sean Astin. And I've got the paperwork to prove it. He actually wrote on a piece of paper, "Dear Kylie, you are now an honorary Goonie," signed Mikey.
Kylie, how long have I known you now? How is this the first time I've heard about this?
I feel like I should have it on my CV. It's like, it's that.
Holy,
it's that good.
Holy crap, you should. On your CV, you should have that tattooed to your forehead.
It is like, I've got to find that piece of paper. I've got it somewhere safe.
Can we back up to the bit where you've breathed the same air as Sean Astin?
Oh, no.
Is this something to do with Lord of the Rings?
It was Lord of the Rings time. I only met him once. And he was a very, like, almost preternaturally nice human being. He is a good man. And he's a good guy and he was just really lovely. And I didn't actually get him to sign that. My mum got it for me because she was working with him, and so she actually got that for me because I would never have dared to
ask him to make you an honorary.
No, that has to come from someone else. That has to.
That is awesome.
I also met his dad once, who I had a massive crush on for, like, my entire early teens because I was such an...
That's reasonable.
Adams Family, like, absolute nut. And John Astin came in to my mum's work because he worked on The Frighteners, which mum was working on as well. And he came in and mum was like, "Oh, my daughter's such a huge fan of yours. Can you come and meet her?" So she came to meet me and I, of course, like an absolute douchebag, I had my hair in two long black plaits that day.
Yeah.
So I was like full Wednesday Addams nerd out in front of the original Gomez Addams. So that's super cool. Anyway, those are my Goonies memories. But I'm honestly, if you want a film that's going to make you feel, it's a bit ropey, like some of the special effects are a bit ropey now, but that film, I still think it stands up. And obviously the whole stuff with the Fratellis is really awkward, but I think it stands up.
What do you think it is about this movie that has like had such an important impression on you?
It's the whole, like, finding, like, unexpected adventure in a really kind of mundane suburban place.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same kind of thing that appealed to me about, like, when I was slightly older, The Lost Boys, and I think there's
I was actually just going to talk about that. Like, yeah. There's this particular 80s aesthetic. The Lost Boys has it. E.T. has it in another way of, like, these... of this kind of, you know, sprawling suburbia that you know, sort of invaded by something insidious and evil, right?
Yeah.
God damn, I love The Lost Boys.
Oh my God, that film.
Oh my God, that's such a good movie.
I swear, like, I basically dedicated myself to that film. And when I was about 15, I think I would have been about 15 when it came out, and it was just my all, everything. I knew every line, I knew every fact about that film. I can't recall hardly any of it now. But a few years ago, I got to actually go to what's the place they actually called? It's called Santa Carla in the movie, but
Santa Cruz.
So I went to Santa Cruz, and the carousel from the opening scene is still there. And the boardwalk looks exactly like it does in the movie, but, you know, it's not quite as 80s and stuff. There's no Frog Brothers comic store, but...
it's the best two Corey's movie, like,
absolutely.
Hands down.
The stuff with the Frog Brothers and his name is Mikey too, isn't it?
Michael. The older brother's name is Michael. Remember
right.
How your so, name yeah, is Michael?
Yeah. That's right.
Oh, it's so
you
good.
Wait till Mom gets home, Mikey. that's just, I love it so much. I love that film so much.
Oh, yeah.
I think Goonies and that one would be probably my two favourite 80s movies.
I mean, I think The Lost Boys is one of my all-time favourite movies ever.
Yeah, absolutely. I had the most amazing experience once with The Lost Boys, actually. We went to one of those, Aunt Timpson, you know, the 48 yes. hour and everything. Yeah. He put on one of those, a secret screening in Wellington. It was at the beach. It was really cool. It was at the beach. It was an outdoor secret screening. You just had to turn up and hope you were going to see something worthwhile. And it was Lost Boys.
Wow.
How about
That's
that?
So cool.
It was really cool.
That's awesome.
It was great.
Yeah, I'd love to see it like that. So I'm a bit younger than you. I've never seen any of these movies at the movies. I know these only through home media. I don't think I've seen a single one of these films on the big screen.
I saw them both on the big screen.
Yeah.
And I just remember walking out after Lost Boys
and thinking... Lost Boys on the big screen would be great.
It was super cool.
Kiefer Sutherland blown up on a big screen with his, like, earrings and his... Oh.
I know. He was so cool.
Oh, my God. He was so cool.
He was so cool. Who was your favourite? Because I actually... Alex Winter...
Yeah, Alex Winter's pretty awesome in that film too.
Yeah.
But definitely Kiefer Sutherland had the biggest impression on me.
So we, like, even my best friend and I at the time, we had, like, this sort of proto fan fiction thing going on where we would, like, tell each other the backstories of each of those characters. We had these, like, really
That's so cool.
detailed backstories for each of them that we'd made
Honestly,
up based
Jason
on.
Honestly, Jason Patrick is also great and very hot in that film. He's never made any other kind of impression on me, but in The Lost Boys,
he's great. He is great.
But I mean, film. I feel like you can't go past Kiefer Sutherland in that movie. It's just, like, the coolest thing that's ever been.
Yeah.
So good. Joel Schumacher, that movie is.
Yeah, actually, there's a really awkward director's commentary with him talking about, because that, I don't know if you know, if you've watched that film again as an adult, but there's a lot of, like, homoerotic subtext in that film.
Yeah, it's, I last saw loaded it like 15 years ago.
Right, and some of it is even, like, actually, Kiefer Sutherland's death scene is probably the most blatant.
Where but it, he gets isn't that one of the things that's great huge, about it? Isn't that one of the things that's really good
yeah.
about it? That there's that the whole thing is, like, swathed in sex. Like, I mean, like, vampire things are, you know?
Yeah, they are.
That's part of the genre.
With that. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We should do a whole episode of... I might watch it today.
Should we do a Lost Boys episode?
I think we should do a whole episode of Lost Boys.
Yeah. And look, I was going to say we should do an 80s movie episode, but I've also picked an 80s movie.
Tell me, what's your movie?
So I was going to do The Wizard of Oz, because I think that The Wizard of Oz is the first thing that I, like, obsessively fangirled out over.
Mm.
I loved it. I was an only child. I used to literally watch The Wizard of Oz every day.
Uh-huh.
I absolutely adored it. And once, when I was about 3 or 4, I got lost in the Maidstone Wall in a flat. Which is not a big space to get lost in.
It's a great one big room.
Yeah. So I got lost in there. And, you know, my parents, like, told the manager or whatever, and eventually, you know, this thing comes out of a loudspeaker to come and get me, and the manager's like, well, we think we found your daughter. Like, we're positive it's her, but she insists that her name's Dorothy and she comes from Kansas.
That's hilarious.
So I was going to do The Wizard of Oz, but instead I've chosen Back to the Future.
Oh, because I think classic.
Back to the Future is not only... I mean, possibly if I was pushed, my favorite movie of all time, but it just, there's so many elements of it that have, like, that I can see that I love in so many other pop cultural things that I love, right?
I reckon there are a few films that are, like, are perfect, and I think that Back to the Future is one of them. It's so good. I mean, that's Robert Zemeckis, right? And I think he's just such a great, but it's also Robert Zemeckis being handheld by Steven Spielberg, and I think that they are a great team. They were a great team.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, and it's that 80s thing of, like, you know, teenagers being cool and, like, saving the world, you know. Yeah, I mean, it's got a real, real 80s vibe, but it's quite a dense movie. And so one of the things, I mean, again, everyone on the planet has seen Back to the Future up 10 times, but very briefly, there's a kid played by Michael J. Fox who's friends with a mad scientist played by Christopher Lloyd. Christopher Lloyd makes a time machine out of a DeLorean. Michael J. Fox.
You made a time machine out of a DeLorean?
Out of a DeLorean. Michael J. Fox accidentally goes back 30 years. Meets up with his parents when they were teenagers in the 50s, so he goes from 1985 to 1955. Meets up with his friends, with his parents when they were teenagers. His mum falls in love with him because she doesn't know that he's her son. That it's not quite as weird as it sounds. Like, it should be a lot grosser than it is. It's played for laughs very, very well. And then Michael J. Fox has to find 30 years ago Christopher Lloyd and get him to repair the time machine and send him back to the future.
So one of the things that is so great about that film is who plays his dad. It's the most bizarre casting, but the most
Crispin Glover plays his dad. And he's so good in it. But it's kind of perfect for Crispin Glover, that role, right? Because he plays his dad both now and 30 years ago. And he's like awkward and strange and, like, you know, totally misunderstood by everybody. And that's kind of perfect for Crispin Glover because that's what Crispin Glover is.
That is literally who he is.
That is literally Crispin Glover.
So good.
But all of the casting's so great. Like,
yeah, absolutely. I mean,
everything about them. You know, originally Eric Stoltz played Marty McFly.
Wouldn't have had the same energy.
There is floating around the internet, there are photos. I don't know if there's any film, but there are stills of Eric Stoltz because they shot, like, a decent chunk of the film. And then I think Robert Zemeckis was just like, you're not giving me the right energy. You know, like, I feel like Eric Stoltz, he would have been far more serious.
Yeah, a bit too cerebral.
And a bit too cerebral.
Marty needs to be smart, but not thinky.
Yeah.
Which is what he is. Which
is how Michael J. Fox plays him. Fuck, Michael J. Fox is amazing in this role.
He's so good.
But yeah, it was a whole thing because, like, Eric Stoltz and Leah Thompson were maybe dating, or at least were, like, good friends at the time, and it was, like,
oh,
quite
right?
books.
Oh, that would
yeah.
be
good. Anyway.
She's fantastic in it as well. I love
Sorry?
Her.
Sorry? She's so good. She's so good. The 1955 scenes, I mean, she's amazing. She also made me desperately want to be a 1955 teenager.
Yeah, her clothes are so great.
Solely because of that dress that she wears in the dance scene at the end.
Yes. So good. There's been a few criticisms of the film, but then everything from the 80s, like, none of that stuff is, like, pure anymore. I mean, anything that's kind of
it was a hard sell largely because of that mother falling in love with her son thing.
Yeah, well, actually it's funny that you mentioned that because there used to be I remember the advert being on TV, and there's that line the doc says, your mum's got the hots for you, or you've got the hots. And my mum overheard that, and she was like, you are never seeing that film.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you don't get it.
He wrote the script with Bob Gale, And they shopped it for years. And actually, interestingly, the reason... So in the movie... I mean, his parents were teenagers 30 years ago and he's only 18, right? So his parents are a lot older than him.
Right.
And he has two older siblings in the movie who weren't in the original script, but they had to keep adding older siblings to make it believable that his parents were teenagers in the 50s, because I think that was the important thing, was that they were teenagers in 1955. That's what they wanted to go back to.
Right.
The today was just whenever today was. So say they originally wrote the script in the late 70s, which kind of makes more sense time-wise.
Right, you know. Oh, I see. So
they had to keep adding older siblings to make it more viable, and so and his siblings are a lot older, and so I think the idea is that he's like their kind of accident late in life baby.
Right.
But
quite like
my in-laws live on a massive train line, and really long trains go by. There's one going by right now.
Oh, okay. I can't hear it.
It's not gonna. Okay. One of the things that I love about Back to the Future, and that has definitely fed through into the other pop culture that I love, is that every single thing in that film is important. Every detail is significant, and everything, and when you get to the end of the movie, you can go back and unpack all of those tiny little details, been leading you to the end, which is just so brilliant and so well done. So, you know, things like when there's the scene quite near the beginning when Marty and his girlfriend are like making out on a bench, and then a woman comes over and interrupts them, and she's like, "Save the clock tower, take the flyer." And Jennifer writes down her phone number on the flyer, and both of those things are significant later. So the details that are on the flyer are significant later, and also the fact of her having written down her phone number is significant later. Like every single little detail in that film is important, and I fucking love that. That just makes me so happy.
Yeah, it's so good. I mean, that's what comes when you've spent, you know, so long crafting the script.
You're
50 drafts in, you know, you're gonna be able to do that kind of stuff. It's the stuff, kind of thing that doesn't happen these days, because, you know, first drafts bloody in production before you've even put the final words.
Oh, you're still writing it. You're in production and you're still doing rewrites.
Shocking.
So that's one of the things I love about it, and that I can definitely see that has fed through into the things that I love today. And the other thing, I love everything about this movie, every single thing, but something else that I think is significant for me and the other things that I love is that it's like the themes and the broad subject matter are like really serious and deep, and lead you, if you start to concentrate too hard on them, into like very strange places in your brain about, you know, time travel and and nature versus nurture and free will and all that kind of stuff. But it's carried in such a light way. Like, it's a hilariously funny movie. But
it does some really heavy lifting for something that's so...
But it does really heavy lifting.
Yeah, that's so easy
that's
to watch.
That's putting it.
That's a really good choice.
Yeah, I love that film so much. A few, oh, not
and
a
I
few.
I think it's really aged really well.
10, oh, yeah, it has. About 10 years ago now, I would say. I was in the States, and I was at my aunt and uncle's house, and I, like, threw a hip out like an old lady.
What? How did you do that?
I'm not really sure, but I did something, and I have, like, slightly funky hips. I was born with hip dysplasia.
Oh, right.
And my hips are, like, a little bit whack, and I don't know, like, I did something, and I threw a hip out, and I spent a couple of days lying on a bed. And one of the, you know, 900 cable channels that my aunt and uncle have was playing a Back to the Future marathon, and I watched all three movies three times. So terrible.
That's awesome. But, you know, that's the thing about those things. There's something you find every time that's, you know, every time you watch it again, I think one of the things I loved about it, and one of the things that I wish people did more of, is that they obviously didn't know they were going to get to make 2 and 3, but they made, when they did, they'd made 2 and 3 with each other and each film in mind, and so all together those films work as like one giant 6-hour movie, and I think it's absolutely brilliant. It doesn't, none of the sequels sort of undermine the first film. They actually make the first film richer.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And when they and also play, you know, calling back to stuff that was in the first film, it's just really, really, really good.
It's a great trilogy.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's one of the great trilogies, one of the great film trilogies.
Absolutely.
For sure. Oh, should we move on to some music?
I would just like
to say.
I just go and watch it right now. I love it. Anyway, okay, yeah, so music. I chose Duran Duran because they're great. Like, if you listen, everything up to Notorious, which is a very mediocre album, sorry guys, but because I know that they'll eventually be listening to this, obviously.
Yeah.
I would say the first three albums, Duran Duran, Rio, and Seven and the Ragged Tiger, are just absolute genius. And also, the lyrics are complete nonsense, so they're enjoyable for kids of all ages. And also,
Union of the Snake has a soprano sax solo.
Speaking of sax solos, The Lost Boys got the greatest musical of all time. Oiled bodybuilder saxophonist. What the hell?
We should do an episode where we watch Lost Boys and just narrate as we go.
Yeah, I think we should. We should totally do that. Okay.
Some weird podcast next week come out of lockdown, people.
Yeah, next week's episode. But yeah, and there's a lot of saxophone in Duran Duran, and there's something about their kind of, I don't know. It always made me feel quite inspired and quite creative because it is absolute gibberish. You can kind of, I don't know,
but
take
so
anything
fun
you want from it. It's so much fun. It's incredibly danceable.
And
there's something about Simon Le Bon's voice that's quite easy to sing along with. I don't know. I just absolutely love them so much.
Yeah.
And they were a very, very significant part of my youth. And but I've never seen them live. I've never, ever seen them live.
I'm sure they'll
tour. Which is real bad. Yeah, but I don't even know if I want to see them. Because they're still producing music, which I find kind of slightly hilarious. Yeah, they still
have albums and stuff.
Yeah. Just the four of them now. Or maybe three. Because I think Roger Taylor left. No, they're all fine. I think Andy Taylor's gotten close a couple of times, guitarist.
All right, okay.
But he's not with them anymore.
Right.
They had a big reunion tour where the five of them got back together, and Andy Taylor proceeded to have a sort of mild meltdown and left again. Yeah. He's the one that's the least, like, cool.
Stable
and cool. He's the least cool. He's the one who had the giant mullet through the whole of the 80s.
Yes. That's an iconic mullet.
It was an iconic mullet.
That would be up there with the great mullets.
It's in the mullet.
Him, John Bon Jovi.
Oh, God. Yeah, I forgot about that. It's like a fluffy mullet. That's like a mullet plus. A flullet.
There's a great, there's a really, really good Hit Parade. I've talked to you about the podcast Hit Parade. There's a really good Hit Parade episode on Bon Jovi and, like, associated hair bands from the 80s. I highly recommend it. It's excellent.
I'm gonna check that out. But yeah, I think my favourite album was Seven and the Ragged Tiger because it felt like a kind of weird sci-fi fantasy sort of political. It wasn't. It was just total bollocks.
On it, right? Hungry Like the Wolves on that album.
Is it? I can't
is it not?
Remember.
Oh, maybe. No, you, I mean, you definitely know Duran Duran better than I do.
Rio and Seven and the Ragged. I'm pretty sure that. But I had a massive crush on Nick Rhodes. Like, I was obsessed by him.
I don't know what he looks like. I have to look him up.
He just looks like a very ordinary Englishman who wore a lot of makeup, basically.
Wikipedia has a photo of him in 2012, which is not doing it for
me. Yeah, it's not a good look. He's certainly no John
Nick Rhodes in the 80s.
He's certainly no John Taylor, who is as beautiful now as he was in the 80s. But in a slightly different way.
Oh, yeah, okay, I see it.
But I really like their first album, which is just basically five people who have no idea what they're doing making noises. But I love that album. I do really love that album. When I was living in London, like, the closest I've ever been to them is when I was living in London, I went to watch them do a signing at HMV.
Yeah.
It was just like a bunch of middle-aged women screaming, and me and my best friend standing there going, yeah, we're totally unmoved by this. But deep down inside, we were pretty moved. And then I went to the premiere of Lord of the Rings, the first one.
Yeah.
And Nick Rhodes was there, and my then husband insisted on dragging me over and introducing ourselves to him. And he introduced me as, "This is my wife Kylie, she loved you when she was a child." And thank God Nick Rhodes was so drunk he could barely stand up. Sorry, Nick. But
thank God.
He couldn't remember, so he'll never remember that whole horrible
it's
thing.
Like, it's like Empire Records.
It was pretty awkward.
That's so funny. Oh, dear.
It was terrible. Terrible fan moment.
I've chosen sort of a less cool musical act, I think. I've chosen Paul Simon, so like all the music of Paul Simon, which is something that was handed down to me, actually, by my dad, who was a big, like, 60s folk fan. And so obviously Simon and Garfunkel are like very important in that scene. And yeah, so that was the kind of music that I grew up listening to, and definitely something that my dad was like, you know, you should listen to this. This is some great music. I think Paul Simon is, I'm the first person that's ever said this, Kylie. I think Paul Simon's a genius.
I could listen to Simon and Garfunkel for the rest of my life and be happy, I think. So.
Look, I have also turned out, like, I mean, not exclusively, but I've also grown into a person who really loves folk music. I love a good close harmony so much.
I'm a big fan.
And, you know, like, modern iterations of that, like, you know, Fleet Foxes. And if you want to hear a really good version of a Paul Simon song, actually, go find a Swedish duo called First Aid Kit, that's what they do. They do close harmony, but they did this amazing live cover of America, which is like incredible. Go find that. I'll put it in the show notes.
Yes, please do.
But yeah, so Paul Simon again. I mean, it's so much of what I like in music now. I can like trace back to him and to that style of music. So I'm a big sucker for like a poetic lyric. I'm a big sucker for a close harmony. I'm a big sucker for a single instrument, not necessarily just a guitar. Like, actually, another thing that I thought about doing for this segment was Tori Amos, who was extremely important to me as a teenager. And I was quite an angsty, like, woeful teenager. And loved listening to angsty, woeful Tori Amos.
I think you could go, two ways. It's like Kate Bush or Tori Amos. And I think I went down the Kate Bush path because I was a bit older than you. But
that's probably, partly just you and I being at different points in our generation. But, you know, if I had heard Kate Bush at the right kind of formative time, I would have been Kate Bush instead of Roy as well. So that's music for me now. And it's not just Simon and Garfunkel. I really like a lot of Paul Simon solo stuff as well. I think Hearts and Bones is an amazing and underrated album. He wrote it about his divorce from Carrie Fisher.
Carrie Fisher, yeah, I was just about to mention her.
Yeah, so that's a good pop cultural crossover, actually.
I was actually going to say, there is a nerd connection. There's a nerd connection there. Yeah.
Briefly married to Carrie Fisher. She was supposed to get... She left Dan Aykroyd for him.
Oh, my God, really?
Yeah.
What a romantic career that woman had.
She was, like, totally engaged to Dan Aykroyd. She had gone out with Paul Simon, then they split up, and then she got engaged to Dan Aykroyd. They did, like, Blues Brothers together and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she was like, actually, I'm going back to Paul Simon.
Wow.
Yeah. And now he's married to, and has been for a long time, to Edie Brickell.
Yes, I did know that, actually.
Yeah.
I had a bit of a brief flirtation with Edie Brickell in the 90s.
That one album was good.
Yeah, it was.
Ghost of a Dog.
There were some really good female singer-songwriters in the 90s that kind of came out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and that was, so I was a teenager in the 90s.
Annie DeFranco and stuff as well.
Yeah, yeah. Like Heather Nova, like, there was some.
Who was the one who had those really good eyeglasses? She had the cat's eyeglasses.
Lisa Loeb, Stay in Parentheses, I Missed You.
Actually, those, I often think of all those singers as being like slightly Pacific Northwest-y vibe, like almost Seattle-y, but I think maybe I just thought everything came from Seattle.
It's just that everything in the 90s was centered around Seattle. They probably all moved to Seattle.
Probably.
Or Athens, Georgia.
Yeah.
Those were the two places it was acceptable to be from in the 90s.
That's right.
Yeah, so I was listening to all of those girl singers in the 90s. That was definitely my jam. And obviously, I mean, because I was a person with ears, obviously, like Pearl Jam and Nirvana and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I was very deeply into those girl singers. But that's not how I chose Paul Simon. So it's music. That music has, like, been with me very consistently since I was a small child. And it's music that I turn to now when I need to feel, like, calm and grounded.
Right, right. You know? So it connects
that's
you
what
to
I turn
your,
to. Yeah, yeah. And I think that I do probably have that to thank for a lot of the music that I've gone on to. Like, I do have pretty broad music tastes, but, like, I can't go past a great close harmony. I've recently
what's your
been listening
favorite?
To Haim, who are about to put out a new album. Do you know Haim?
No. How's that spelled? Like
Haim.
No.
So
I don't
they're
know.
A
kind
trio.
Of gave up. I gave up on music a while ago, so I just listened to five bands over and over and over.
No, go ahead. I mean, if you like something a bit folky, go ahead and listen to Haim.
I do like a bit of folk. I like a lot of sort of British sixties folk is like I'll go anywhere for the Watersons. And
sure.
I love Martin Carthy and
yep.
absolutely love him. And
right there
obviously
with you.
Like Leisure Leaf is probably one of my favourite albums of all time. In fact, I think it probably might actually be no. I'm getting ahead of myself. Go on, sorry.
No, I think I'm done. I mean, yeah, Paul Simon. That's what I would like
we should
to pass
do
on
like
to my children.
I didn't realise that we had a bit of a folk connection there.
Should we do
what
a folk episode?
Actually, what was the movie I was watching just the other day? Just come out. And there were, like, the Watersons and Martin Carthy were on the soundtrack. And I was like, what the hell is going on? It was amazing. I might
find it and we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll stick it in the show notes if I figure it out. Right, so books.
Books.
Books. So I've kind of realised that I might have picked something that's
just
slightly...
Romy is literally standing outside a window, like a ranch slider, banging on it.
Oh, please.
And looking at me.
I was just thinking the other day about when I came up to your house and hours later she said, where's that lady? How unnerving that must have been for her. It's like, is that woman still just wandering around her house somewhere?
Is she still in Mummy's wardrobe?
She lives there now. Oh, please.
Anyway, sorry.
As an aside, so what's my book? The book that I've got. So I've chosen a book and I think it might be slightly embarrassing to me.
I don't know this book. This is the only thing that we've talked about that I don't know.
Okay, so it's a book called, I can barely say the name. It's a book called The Silver Metal Lover, and it's by a British novelist, Tanith Lee. And she is a big sci-fi and fantasy writer. Also, she wrote a lot of, like, feminist and LGBTQ positive sort of stuff in the in the 80s and 70s and 80s. She was British and she's quite, you know, she won a lot of awards. She died in 2015 breast cancer, and she left the trilogy that this book is part of unfinished.
Yeah. Okay,
so it's part of the Silver series, and there's two books, The Silver Metal Lover and Metallic Love. I haven't read Metallic Love because The Silver Metal Lover had such a profound effect on me, and when Metallic Love came out. Okay, so it's about this girl called Jane. She's like the only child of a high-powered, incredibly rich woman who basically coddles her and is domineering. So basically she's got this domineering mother, and her friends are all a bit crap. But she sees on the street a robot minstrel, basically, and falls in love with it. And they're this kind of, they're very much like humans in every way, except that they're not, they're robots. Anyway, so she, while her mum's away from work, she sells everything she owns in the house and buys this robot and goes on the run with it, basically. And that's it. It's like this weird sort of, they're having this kind of romance, and outside in the world that she's just totally ignoring because they're in their little bubble. Out in the real world, there's this kind of major social upheaval going on. And that's one of the things that's so interesting about the book, is that she creates this very detailed, very broken society that this kind of quite intimate little story goes on.
You know,
it's the backdrop to this quite intimate little story between this girl and this robot that she's in love with. And It's really beautiful. It's got some weird sort of semi-spiritual stuff at the end that, you know, take it or leave it. But it's I love it. I love it so much. And there's been a new comic book come out with art and some sort of editing by Colleen Duran and Gail Simone, who are two of my favorite comic book people. So it's got its fans, and you know, it's got its fans, and I don't know what else I can say about it other than that it had a very profound effect on me, and I might have to read it again. But I've been wary of reading it again because, you know, when you go back to those things as an adult, it's hard to appreciate them in the same way that you did when you first read it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I don't know. And also there's been so, I mean, I've read and seen so many kind of more mature examinations of that kind of thing. I mean, when we were actually, well, we were until very recently, cruising towards a future where AI is a real thing.
Yeah. It would be interesting to read it through that lens.
Yeah, I think it could be, because Silver has a lot of agency, so he's not exactly like, it's not like he's a sort of one of those sort of real doll kind of things. He's got,
yeah,
he is a person with his own sort of motivations and stuff.
Yeah,
but it doesn't really ask any of those questions in the same way that something like modern, like Ex Machina does, about, you know, can you ever, even if you're seeing human emotions in a mechanical thing, is that, can you ever expect them to adhere to certain moral standards or ethical standards or whatever, you know, that they can't possibly.
Can you, is there such a thing as like a facsimile of humanity?
Yeah. But really, Silver is basically a facsimile of humanity. Yeah. So it's not quite, I haven't read it recently, so I wonder if I would pick up more on those sort of things now as an adult reading it than I did when I was a teenager, where I was just like, I don't know, it was more of a kind of, you know, about finding your person, your clique, your, you know, as a teenager, that's so important to find those people that you connect with, and she just happens to connect with a robot.
Yeah.
But so that, to me, is what I remember the book being about finding your place in the world rather than anything to do with, like, the ethics of AI or...
I mean, that was the kind of thing... Oh, you know, I guess that's a subject that a lot of teen culture, teen-facing pop culture is interested in, right? Because it's a kind of universal thing for teenagers. Like, who am I? Who are my people? Will I ever feel like I fit in anywhere?
Yeah, exactly. And I remember it being quite... You know, she's got a lot of friends, but they're kind of... There are a lot of frenemies in her group of people, and she kind of comes to realise which are the ones that are really worthwhile and which aren't. And that's sort of, it's more about, it's very much a YA book about relationships rather than about the science fiction side, you know what I mean? Which is the best, you know, really the best science fiction is like that anyway. So
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, where it's not, I mean, and I guess that's kind of what I meant about Back to the Future in some ways as well.
Yeah.
Like, all of those questions are there. And the movie's not at all shying away from them, but at the same time, it's not the key interest of the film. It's not,
it's there to entertain you. It's entertaining.
I mean, not that these are
while...
bad movies at all. In fact, they're both movies that I like, but it's not like Pi or Donnie Darko or something where the point of it becomes trying to you know, figure out these very intricate, like, you know, metaphysical questions.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, because that's the thing about, there's a lot of, I don't know. Maybe I should read Metallic Love and come back and report.
Interestingly, the book I've read is a bit like that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I picked a YA book, unsurprisingly, by a New Zealand author called Cheryl Jordan. It's called The Juniper Game.
I've never heard of it.
Oh, okay. So I probably read this book. I would say I was about 12 when I read this book, and it had a very profound effect on me. So it's about a girl. Can you hear Romy in the background?
A little bit, but I think it's kind of cute. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's totally fine. Everybody knows we're all in close quarters at the moment, hey?
Yeah, we are. So the Juniper Game is about a girl called Juniper, who is telepathic, and she kind of knows things. It's not so much that she can, like, read minds, but she knows things about people and about things that are going on. But she's starting to learn as the book begins that she can also see back in time. She can't really, it's not that she can time travel, like she can't corporeally time travel.
Okay.
But she has a sort of connection to the past and to a very specific medieval woman in the past.
Oh, I love that.
Head she can kind of get into.
That's cool.
And so she's, she befriends like the, funnily enough, you would think she would be, but in the book, she's not like a weird kid. I mean, she's sort of reasonably popular and has, right. and her boyfriend is like a super popular, like alpha dude. But she's starting to train herself to like communicate with, or not communicate with, but like connect herself to this woman in the past, and she wants to be able to document it somehow, and she realizes that the school nerd, who has a lot of his own kind of issues at home and stuff like that, his mum is kind of has just abandoned the family and he's taking responsibility for the younger siblings. She realizes that he is a very, very gifted artist, and so they start working together. She like goes back and she goes back and sees the world through this woman's eyes, and she tells Dylan, the boy, what she sees, and he draws it. So he's documenting what she's seeing.
Cool.
And then, yeah, which is already like just such a great idea and super cool. Then they realize that the woman that she's connected to is going to be, I can't remember if she's going to be burnt or drowned, but she's going to be executed because they think she's a witch.
Right.
And so then they start trying to figure out what they can do with it. And then obviously the whole thing gets like darker and a lot more dangerous.
How is this not a movie?
I don't know. It should have been, eh?
It's cool.
It's such... So, but this book, I mean, I really, really loved it. And there's a lot of things that I can see kind of carrying through to stuff that I love now. I mean, for a start, it's really feminist. Like, it's got this very strong... It's got this very feminist central character, Juniper. She's very strong, she's very assertive, she's very complicated, she doesn't always make the right decisions. She's maybe slightly using Dylan, who definitely over the course of the book becomes completely infatuated with her.
Right.
But just this, it's such a brilliant idea, the story. And what I always loved about it, and I'm actually often this way with things like this that are a bit fantastical, my favorite bits were the bits in the today parts where she and Dylan are trying to like figure out what's going on and what they're going to do about it and how far into it they can go. I found that kind of more interesting than the bits where she's being connected to this woman in the past. Like, I guess what I'm saying is that while it is fantastical, if not strictly speaking a fantasy, it's also a really compelling human drama.
Yeah.
The characters are incredibly well created and described and observed, and everything. There's a lot of side characters as well that are really interesting. So like Juniper is a single mother, and at one point it is not explicitly stated but very strongly suggested that Juniper is actually the product of a rape.
Oh wow. So yeah, really there's a lot going on in it.
Yeah, there's like a lot going on. The characters are amazing, the story's fabulous, and again, I mean, this is more explicitly asking some pretty big metaphysical questions,
yeah.
But it doesn't at all shy away from it considering the age group that it's I mean it's a teen novel. Cheryl Jordan, I mean, she's brilliant, and she wrote several books that I really loved as a kid that do the same kinds of things, that have the same interests. So I think she's best known for one called Winter of Fire.
Okay. I don't know any of this. I must have just, like, because of our different ages, I think I must have just missed this completely.
Ages, yeah.
Because it would be so
I'm just
up
looking
my alley
this up.
In any other circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't reread these books for quite a long time, but, you know, I should go back to them. So, yeah, The Juniper Game was published in 1991. I probably read it that year. I turned 11 in 91, so I probably read it that year or the following
right,
year.
Right, right.
But, yeah, you would have been a little bit...
Just a little bit older.
A little bit. Yeah, maybe just not reading YA anymore at that point, even though you still would have, I think, really liked it.
Yeah, it would have really... Have you ever read The Changeover? Margaret Mahey's The Changeover?
Yeah, of course.
God, that book is incredible.
Yeah, love that book.
But there's the thing about that, like what you were saying about that book, is that the family drama is...
Yeah, I was exactly the same with The Changeover and The Haunting.
Yeah.
Both of those.
I don't think I connected with The Haunting quite as much as The Changeover. Did you see the film? It was so disappointing. I feel so bad about it.
I don't think I have seen the film, no.
I know what they were trying to do, but it just didn't work. Although they cast a creepy guy really brilliantly with, what's his name? With Timothy Spall, played the bad guy. And
he
was great. Perfect casting. But unfortunately, the film didn't quite grab. And also they, anyway. And what age do you think you'll give that to Romy to read? And Sam, sorry. I don't know why, I just thought because of a female protagonist, I often think that, but
I mean, it does have a strong female protagonist, but I wouldn't say that it's a book that a boy who's typically interested in like adventure or whatever would not connect with. Even though it does have that human drama. I read it when I was 12. I was a fairly precocious reader, but I would say that's probably about the age, like maybe 12 through 14, 15. The characters, I think, are like 15.
Right.
And I read it a number of times too as a teenager. It was something I came back to a lot.
Why do you think so many YA books, or is it just because those are the ones that I tended to read when I was younger, but why do you think so many YA books have that fantasy or...
it's interesting, isn't it?
Sci-fi element to them. It is, yeah, eh? Because it's
a good question.
Do you think it's because teenagers in the real world, their lives are quite limited, so really they don't... Unless there's some kind of something pushing them outside their spheres, their everyday spheres. It's sort of...
Maybe also that they like to imagine that they have this whole other world that's open to them because, you know, teenagers have very little agency. I mean, it's one of the frustrating things about a teenager.
Yeah, that's what I was kind of getting at. So, like, having some kind of superpower or some kind of there being some kind of chosen one or, I don't know. Yeah, it's just weird. I found that kind of interesting.
It's interesting, isn't it? I haven't thought about that before.
But yeah, and I have no answers.
Me neither, but it's something we could ponder and talk about when we do a YA episode.
I really want to read that book. It sounds good.
Yeah, I want to read yours too. Yeah, I think the Juniper game sadly is out of print now.
But
maybe off the back of this podcast, we could create a movement to get it.
Do you know what? I think you should try and buy the rights and produce it.
It would make a great movie.
Not right now, obviously.
Today.
No one producing nothing right now. Hey, you know what? I was just thinking about that, actually, that we're all like, yay, we can binge watch this. Thank God for Netflix and the streamers. Yay. But soon that stuff's going to run out.
I know.
What are we going to do?
We were just talking, Jonathan and I were just talking about it last night because we started watching, finally, Succession.
Oh, my God. What do you think?
So let's talk about that's the subject for another podcast. But Jonathan was like, what was this produced for? And I was like, actually, the reason we started talking about it was because it's got a really, really long credit sequence, opening credit sequence, unusually long for a modern TV show. And Jonathan was like, well, was it created for a streaming service like Netflix where you can skip it? And I was like, no, it's HBO, and they're only just about to launch their own streaming service, but it probably won't get launched. No, it's going to have no content.
No content. Just the one show.
Yeah.
Shit.
It's not even going to have the Friends reunion special.
Oh my God.
Which was one of its, gold-plated platinum. Yeah.
Well, I always had this sort of vision of us all like, everybody's creating so much content. I don't know if you've noticed this, but there's all kinds of content being created of like lockdown content. Lockdown content, you know. People
making. Oh, right. Yes.
Pretty soon we'll all be tuning in for like... stop motion blimmin' toy dramas or whatever. That's what I'm imagining, like 6 months down the track. We're tuning in to watch each other sleep or something. 3 hour long.
You know, actually a possible topic for a podcast. I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't be that easy to do. Maybe it's more like a column. But like, what will pop culture look like? So if we're in lockdown and the world is essentially in lockdown for like 3 months... what will pop culture look like at the end of it?
Will we all turn into like our own reality TV stars? Will we just this is my reality show. This is
people
my
just live streaming lockdown.
Yeah. Fuck out.
Jesus Christ.
Should I leave this in the thing? so that people will know that we thought of that first.
Yeah, we called it.
We called it.
Day 3 of lockdown, we called it.
Oh my God, we'll come back to revisit this in a couple of months when we're like still in lockdown. What will our homes look like? Oh my God, what will we look like?
I mean, what will we look like is the bigger question.
I think so. I'm just going to grow my hair out.
With me because I'm going to have to buzz Sam's head, I think.
Yeah, you're going to have to cut people's hair at some point. There's going to be a lot of home haircuts.
Well, so. I'll just grow mine. I mean, I can do my own fringe, so I'll just let my hair grow. I'm okay with it. I've thought about this quite a lot. I'm okay with that.
I didn't buy any hair dye. I've got
so
no
Jonathan
hair
and Sam are both going to wind up with buzz cuts.
There's going to be a lot of buzz cuts coming out of this, though, I'm pretty sure.
There's going to be a lot of buzz cuts. Have you seen that meme going around? Like, we're going back to the age of parents cutting their hair. And it's just all of this.
Yeah. I might end up with a bowl cut. I think there's going to be... I've already seen a couple of stress haircuts as well, where people have like, oh, why did I do this? Cut my own hair.
Look, as recently as a couple of years ago, I had a bowl cut that I actually really liked.
I thought that was cute.
A lot of maintenance to keep it neat. I'll go back to it one day when I have more time. But, you know, like, my hair grows so fast that I need to get it cut, like, every 3 weeks
to keep it sharp.
Because the thing with that cut is the second it grows out, it starts to grow out, it just looks shaggy and terrible.
Yeah. I remember you had that when you started with us. I thought it was cute.
Yeah.
It was very cute.
I'll get it back one day.
Well, guys.
All right. I'm going to go pay attention to my kids.
You should do that. This has been... This has been podcast. I did it again. I'm just going to do that. This is our sign off now. This has been podcast. This is Off Script. I'm Kylie Klein-Nixon.
And I'm Emily Brooks.
We'll see you guys later. Oh, hey, come and check us out on Facebook at OffScriptNZ. And... on Twitter, where we're NZ_off, and let us know how your lockdown's going. Ours is going great, as you can hear.
Great. Yeah, I'm going to start posting some wildly erratic Facebook content.
You definitely should.
You should definitely follow us.
Bye.
See you
later. Bye.